And now I am going to turn it over to Bob, who is going to talk to us about boards and fiscal responsibility.
But what I did was I was asked to put together a little presentation about the fiscal responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility of board members, how they relate to the financial condition, reporting responsibilities, and so forth of the board. And the way I arranged this was, this outline was kind of the easy items to the more difficult ones. So if we start out with the external reporting requirements, those are pretty straightforward. They're set out by the IRS and also the Pennsylvania Bureau of Charitable Organizations. The IRS says each year you have to file a Form 990 or the Form 990EZ form. It's an information reporting form. And your organization was actually eligible to file the 990EZ, which is a shorter form, because your gross receipts for 2010-2011 year should be less than $200,000. And again, they define gross receipts here as the gross receipts. You cannot net out related expenses. So for example, if you do a concert and charge admission fees, pay the performer, and you net a certain amount, they count the gross take, not the net receipts. And I did see that your treasurer's report, your budgets are all set up on the gross receipts basis. So that's perfect. That's the way it's defined for the external reporting that the IRS requires. Now, I didn't know whether you are aware of the Pennsylvania Bureau of Charitable Organization reporting requirements. Are you following those requirements for your organization? Okay, good. You're aware of that. What type, do you engage an outside CPA, an outside auditor, to prepare financial statements for the organization?
No.
No. Okay. You may need to take a look at that. Under my outline, number B2, it says, gives a breakdown of what types of financial statements are required to be submitted with this information form that the state requires, the BCO 10 report, and also with a copy of your 990EZ. And they say, basically, if your contributions and fundraising are less than $50,000, you can use internal financial statements. So you say, oh, that sounds great. You know, our contributions are, according to your budget, last year's budget, $8,000. We have another $4,000 or $5,000 of fundraising, so we're well below that $50,000 threshold. You have to read the instructions. Pennsylvania defines contributions as including grants. So when you add all those up together from your budget, you're at a little over $57,000 of contributions and fundraising receipts. And then that puts you in the category of requiring compiled, reviewed, or audited financial statements. Now, to get any one of those three, you have to engage an outside CPA. You can't do that yourself. Basically, the distinctions between those three types of services, there are three different levels of service. A compilation, if you engage a CPA to do a compilation, which, based on my review of your, like I said, your budget and your current year's financial statements, you would qualify for compilation. All that means is the accountant is coming in, taking your numbers, and putting them in the appropriate format for nonprofit organizations required by the Financial Accounting Standards Board. But just taking your numbers, putting them in a set format. They don't check into those numbers at all. They don't verify them at all. They take them verbatim. Now, if something look out of line, if you said you had a $10,000 CD and you give it to the accountant and say it's $1 million because you forgot the decimal points, yeah, they're supposed to question those things. But anything else, if it's not, it doesn't look questionable on its face, they're taking your word for it. Now, the next level of service is called a review. And what this is the CPA applies inquiry and an analysis to your financial statements, but again, it's not an audit. So what they may look at is you report your assets as being cash. You have a checking account, a savings account, checking account, certificates of deposit, some type of an equity account, you call it, and petty cash. They might look and say, okay, show me the reconciled bank statement for the end of the year. Yep, it matched. The reconciled matches your financial statements. Check. That's all they do. They don't look into how that reconciliation was done. They don't confirm the balance independently with the bank. They don't look to see what type of expenses were being flowed through that statement. It just matched. And then they do analysis. Typically your fundraisers have been making up 40% gross profit or net profit. Okay, this year it's 38%. Yeah, that's reasonable. On to the next item. Okay, our events raised on average 20% of our admissions, less all expenses, went to our bottom line. Okay, this year it's 25%. Well, that's about 20%. Okay. That's the type of inquiry and analysis that is done at a review level. To get any kind of a detailed examination of your receipts, your expenses, independent confirmation of donations received, of testing of the revenues that came in, of the expenses that were paid, require an audit. Now, that's a lot more comprehensive service, a lot higher fee. Compilation, I would, if you said to a CPA, what would it be? I would say you're running probably $1,000 range. And in there, I'm also including the 990 preparation, probably going to run about $1,000. A review might run $2,500 to $3,000, and an audit might be $5,000 or $6,000. And you say, but yeah, we're only a $100,000 organization. Unfortunately, with a review, with an audit, there are certain procedures that have to be followed no matter what your size. So if it says, we have to independently confirm the balance with the bank, well, you do that with an organization that's $50 million, you do it in an organization that's $100,000. Same procedure, probably the same amount of time, but it's much more, an audit for an organization your size is much more extensive. So we'll talk about some suggestions I have for you later on where the board may gain some more assurance as to what's happening with our financial without expending those types of fees to hire an outside CPA to come into your organization. Any questions about that? The state reporting?
You say you get the compiled report, it's about $1,000, is that what you say?
I would expect, okay. Yeah.
And then
$1,000, $1,200 okay. Maybe.
And so this is specifically for this Bureau of Charitable Organizations when we do our application.
It's a requirement, right.
Requirement.
Yeah, and it's because they define contributions. If you look up the state statute, it includes grants.
Yeah, and we've looked at that before.
I think we just hit 50,000 because we're aware of that. Once you meet a minimum threshold on gross, I think it's gross annual contribution, then it's a term of art. I understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
you're right.
It's,
exactly.
It's specific categories, but I think at least unless it's gone over, at least historically we've been below the 50,000.
Yeah.
And we haven't, I think the grant money has not gotten more significant until recently.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have not, mm-hmm. And since we're below the threshold, we didn't see any need to have, to go beyond, internally prepared state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But for this, if you hold true to your budget for this current fiscal year and June 30th, you may exceed that 50,000 threshold. Okay. So just to be aware. And then for the state, if you use the Form 990-EZ, you have to submit Form BCO-23. So again, I guess your treasurer, Jim, just be aware of that.
That's a different form, right?
Yeah.
What is that for? What's the BCO-23 for?
The BCO-10 is more of a I'm going to call it background information type form on the organization, because the 990 has to accompany it, and the 990 is very detailed as far as the reporting. The 990EZ is a little shorter form, and it doesn't provide some of the detail that the state would like to see. So they asked for the supplemental BCO 23 form to provide that detail that 990EZ doesn't contain.
Is that in addition to the BCO 10?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And are these, as the 990s are the BCO forms accessible to the public?
You download the whole packet from the website.
Well, I mean, the completed.
Oh, complete.
Yeah, you can. An interested individual can contact the Bureau of Charitable Organizations, request copies. They're not published like the 990s are.
Do we do the easy?
Yes.
Do we do the 990? Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And do you know, Bruce, offhand, have you done the 23 or have you just done the 10?
Oh, yes.
You do both of them anyway. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's the one that files, so
okay.
He's been doing it.
All right.
Okay.
We already have.
Great.
Yeah. Excellent.
Good. Okay. And then the final external reporting requirements you have are the Form 1099s. Again, these go to people who are unincorporated providers of services of $600 or more. Now, we all know how readily artists and performers like reporting income on their tax returns. So you probably get some resistance on getting Social Security numbers. So I would suggest, if you don't do this already, send the W-9 form right with their contract. The W-9 is a form, as an IRS form, used to gather their Social Security number or their EIN number, and just make that a condition of accepting their contract. That way you've got it for the year end.
Very, very often, although not always, they print it on their own contracts. Generally, mm-hmm. contracts get generated from them, and they probably get so tired by asking them for it.
Established groups are doing it,
yeah,
probably, but
yeah.
You know, individuals,
yes,
or some who are,
yes,
just starting out,
yes,
may not.
It can be a little.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that covers the external reporting requirements. Again, it is your board's responsibility as a group to make sure those things are handled for your organization. So you may want to have a year-end checklist or something like that, just to bring that up maybe at your, these forms are due, Johnny, right around November 15th, so you may just want to put that in your agenda just to verify that those forms have been filed on time. Now, the question was raised about, you know, whether the Bureau of Charitable Organizations report is available for public inspection, and it is. But in fact, all your documents are available for inspection. Your 990, your governing documents, that was your original nonprofit application, your bylaws, your articles of incorporation, any policy statements such as your conflict of interest policy is required to be disclosed to the public upon their request, including your financial statements. And actually, your organization's 990EZ is out there on the web. It's under GuideStar. By filing with the IRS, they have an agreement with this GuideStar organization to publish the 990s, and I did look at last year's 990 for the society, so it is out there, and they're published within a couple months of being filed. But the public also has the right to come in to your organization and request copies of those documents. You can indicate that they are available on GuideStar. If they say, well, you know, I don't have access to a computer, I want copies, you are required to furnish them copies within a reasonable time. You can charge for those copies. I think the going rate is something like, if you use the IRS schedule, it's $1 for the first page and 15 cents for each subsequent page. So, you know, you don't have to give it away for free, but you do have to comply with a request to provide that. And there are actually penalties if you do not comply. The penalties can be as much as $50,000 for non-compliance, depending how long you let it lapse without responding or refusing to respond.
These are now federal guidelines or federal requirements, or the state?
That's a federal requirement, the IRS requirement. I think it's I think it's a fee of $20 a day, and it can aggregate up to $50,000.
What's a governing document? What would be under that category?
Your bylaws, articles of incorporation, mm-hmm. Any policies that you have. Okay, so that, again, that's more maybe in the external realm. So now we turn to, you know, what are your internal responsibilities as a board toward the organization? First of all, the board's charged with adopting and approving the annual budget. And in that process, I suggest looking at 3 years of historical data being presented so that the board can see trends. But the fault with using 3 years of historical data, it's easy just to say, okay, well, this is what the trend is, this is what it's going to be for the fourth year. You really have to still stop and think, well, is that a trend we want to continue? Is it a trend that should continue? And always with the eye of what are our program goals for the coming year? And do we need to restructure what we've done in order to accomplish our set goals for the coming year? That the goals should of the organization should come first, and then set up your budget to try to fulfill those goals, rather than just simply taking what's been done in the prior years and carrying those same numbers forward. So, for example, if you have an initiative to introduce new artists to the Central Pennsylvania area, and you say, you know, we've gotten these same 30 groups in for the last 3 years, it's time to bring some new performers, new genres of music to the public. You know, that may be your goal. But if you set up your budget based on historical revenues, admissions, you may not have those same, because these are unknowns and you may not get the same attendance. So you have to decide, how are we going to fund that goal of bringing in those new artists? So just, you know, mm-hmm. kind of on top of mm-hmm. example off the top of my mind, how your program should really drive your budget. But, you know, as I say, as a board, you should be looking at historical trends just to make sure, you know, what's being presented. I'm presuming, Jim, you're putting together a proposed budget? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but really the whole board should have input in that budget. Probably, Jim, you're creating a draft, but then the board has the input in making the fine-tuning and then the final approval for that. And then finally, the budget can also help you forecast cash needs, because I'm imagining your organization does not have steady income, steady expenses month to month. In fact, well, just looking at last month's Treasury report, I saw a huge amount of grant monies come in, so I know it varies month by month. So when you look at the budget, I might suggest looking at almost a budget developed month by month, so that you can forecast cash shortfalls or cash needs. Again, Jim, I don't know if that's something you do kind of behind the scenes, but it's very useful for an organization.
Yeah, we have never, as far as I'm aware, budget. I just took over as treasurer this year, so mm-hmm. I don't think we ever budgeted by month, but we've got monthly data now that mm-hmm. maybe we can work with yeah. going forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess we could go back and get monthly data, too, if we had to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are where are these requirements set forth? Say, for example, the entire board should have input into the budget. Is that some sort of a guideline?
That's a guideline. There's
some entity, some organization, some law, or
no? There's no law. There's no law. This is just simply best practices. My experience, my readings in the nonprofit area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes you know, large organizations will have a finance committee.
You do?
Okay, I wasn't aware of that, yeah. So, yeah, certainly your finance committee is going to work out the details like that. But, and then with that in place, I I should take a step back. I wasn't aware you were using a finance committee.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's where a lot of our the work is done in mm-hmm. the finance committee and presented to the board.
Right, and it should be done at the finance committee level. That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. Good. You're a step ahead of where I would have expected you to be in that regard, so great. I would say the input, the hard work is done at the finance committee level, and then again then presenting it to the overall board for the approval.
It seems to me that the part the board has to be involved in is establishing goals. Mm-hmm. Like you had said earlier, that if you wanted to make some kind of a shift, that's going to be decided in the board and then sort of play out mm-hmm. through the finance committee and through the finances of the organization. And we're certainly going to be doing that and do that every summer. We have a retreat and we talk mm-hmm. about our goals and our priorities, and that's all coming up, and that will help give a little bit more information for Jim when he sits down and does the budgets.
Our next area of responsibility is reviewing and understanding the monthly financial statements. And just my review of the financial statements that Jim prepares, I think there's a lot of good things happening here with them. They're very concise. They don't overwhelm you with a lot of detail. Again, with your finance committee in place, they can be looking at that detail. But as the whole board, you're not overwhelmed with that. They do keep the annual budget in front of you. They do show the actual versus the percentage of budget, and then also the over and under budget, which I think is all good information. So I think you have a nice monthly report for the board to review. Now, a couple things to keep in mind with this report that you're seeing, though, that may want cause you to raise some questions. First of all, the treasurer's report is prepared on the cash basis of accounting. That means it's reporting whatever receipts come in during the month, for the year to date, that's what's shown. Whatever expenses are paid during that period is what is shown. An accrual method matches the revenue to the period and the expenses to the period. So on a cash basis, I can make the cash balance look real good by just simply forgetting to pay the bills for a month or two. Or if we had, like in May, you got a $13,500 grant. Is that grant for the current year ending June 30th, or is that grant money that's scheduled to be expended next year? You've got it included as revenue in this period, but maybe that really belongs to your next fiscal year. So the cash basis is very typical for organizations of this size. It is a lot of work for the treasurer to try to do it on the accrual basis. I wouldn't suggest doing it, but why bring it up as a board is when you review these statements, you may want to ask, well, how much in invoices do we have outstanding? How much of these receipts relate to grants that we have to fulfill in some future period? Along with that, maybe you've received some contributions that have restrictions. And if you're not fulfilling those restrictions, maybe that money is owed back. So you've accounted for it as revenue, but unless the performer is brought in or the purpose is fulfilled, you may owe that money back to the donor. So how is that reflected in the financial statements?
You, in your budgets, do you keep a tab with the explanations? It seems to me you have some explanations as part of it.
Of what?
So the kinds of things that Bob is bringing up. I know that Bruce used to. I'm just not remembering with yours.
Like the grants, for example. I have that grant worksheet, which shows mm-hmm. the grants. This is actually money that was received this year, but some of it, you're right, is for next year's mm-hmm. performances.
Right.
And that's on a separate schedule, shows what we got this year and what applies to next year.
Yeah.
It's not reflected really in here. Mm-hmm. The totals on there.
Right. So for an accrual basis, you wouldn't have included that as revenues.
Right.
This year.
would put it in some kind of prepaid something or
right. Right. And then at the same time, let's say you had a performance, you had the revenues, and the performer takes 2 months to split his invoice. It wouldn't be in your expenses, but yet the revenue is booked. So you would, under the accrual method, you would have to make an estimate of that expense so you could show the expense in the same period as the revenue was recognized. So that's where it really, the accrual really complicates things. I think what's more important is the board here, you know, continue on the cash basis, but just, you know when to raise those questions. You know, hey, in May, $13,500 in grants, how much is that? Do we have to sort of set aside for future that we shouldn't really be counting that income this fiscal year? Maybe how much of additional expenses do we have on, you know, yet to be paid for this current year? Things like that.
You know, I think that you, Jim, you try to alert us when you're talking about your report if there's something
unusual. This big grant that came in.
Right.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Well, to that point, is there a way, or is it done, or is it best practice to include notes on each?
I've seen that done.
Where you say, you know, we got 20,000 here, and the note says.
Yeah.
You know, this is like towards this particular
footnote certain things. Sure. Yeah.
I think we just do that kind of quietly. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we just always know that this belongs to this, or, you know, I mean, that we just never had a...
It's hard to keep track of those. Sometimes there's a lot of numbers from
Yeah.
Okay. But you're suggesting we stay with the cash.
Yeah, I am.
I've been through this.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that makes life a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd be asking an awful lot of your treasurer, who's a volunteer, to convert this to an accrual basis every month. Yeah.
Now, I do some internal accruals, like we pay our insurance all in one lump sum in June. Mm-hmm. Like we expense it over each month. I do a prepaid insurance and expense it.
Okay.
It's all in the same fiscal year, so that doesn't really affect a whole lot, except it evens out the expense.
But the other suggestion I would have for your budget is because you do have fluctuations month to month in your revenues and expenses, if you develop your budget using a monthly basis, you can convert that into a monthly treasurer's report showing the budget numbers, revenues and expenses on a monthly basis as well. So you can, if you compare year-to-date revenues by category, expenses by category against expected revenues and expenses on a month-by-month cumulative basis, may give you some better planning, a better planning tool to see how close you are to budget.
Yeah, I hope to do that next year because the QuickBooks that we you helped us with getting in has that ability to budget
it does,
monthly.
Right. Yes.
So I'm hoping we can do that next year and make that report like you're suggesting.
Yeah, it's a matter of building the database and
getting
it populated. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, finally, the most difficult area for the board is the responsibility for internal controls. Right now, within your organization, only a very small number of people have access to the cash, performing the reconciliations, reviewing expenditures, I guess controlling cash receipts. It's centered in a very few individuals, very typical for an organization this size. So it's hard to develop internal controls within the staff to provide oversight and control. So it really kind of falls back on the board to provide some of that oversight. Three critical areas I think are the cash balances. You know, is cash being reconciled properly? I don't know who does that reconciliation. Is that you, Jim, or is that? Yes.
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean by cash, but when we get a lot of cash coming in from concerts, Is that what you're kind of
talking about? I mean the bank reconciliation
the
here itself.
I'm sorry. Okay.
So okay.
Yeah, that's Jim then.
Okay, so your treasurer is in charge of the bank reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Does anyone else review that work that's being done? Mm-hmm. So you may want to put, you know, an occasional say, well, let's have a volunteer to review the reconciliation and see that everything appears proper. So it would be actually getting the bank statement.
Oh, the bank statement.
Going back to the accounting records, looking at the reconciliation that was done, and just making sure that there aren't irregularities in the reconciliation.
And that reconciliation is done in Quicken, or QuickBooks. And is that where? That's not where you categorize things. That's a different process.
Right.
I mean, could you describe that, what you do with the bank statement when you get it? I don't really know.
Yeah, there's a reconciliation function in QuickBooks. I go in there and it lists all the checks that I have entered, all the deposits that I've entered. And I put in the closing balance from the bank statement. And that should match the closing balance on our books after I check off the checks that have cleared, just like you do with your home account. Mm-hmm. Check off the deposits that have cleared. Mm-hmm. And those two should match. Mm-hmm. If they don't, then I have to go find out why.
Next critical area is the cash receipts. This is the tough one. Mm-hmm. This is the difficult one for everybody. Again, I don't know the specifics how you do it in your own organization. Whether Jess, you're there at every.
So you're talking about now. We're talking about events that have.
This
cash.
Is right. This is.
Yeah, that is really tough. We do have
admissions,
We do have a sheet that
reconciliation sheet.
It's a concert sheet that the way it was set up to work is the seed money gets counted by two people, and then we accept the money for tickets, and then we have to sit. Whoever's sitting there at the desk, it's usually me. But often other people, Bruce has done it quite a bit in the past. We have to fill out how many tickets were sold in each category and try to match that to the cash that came in. And then also put in notes how much is deposited, what the category is, it snacks, is it ticket sales, is it membership, so mm-hmm. that we try to divide everything and have everything balance. And then I would send that sheet to Bruce, who's keeping track of that. And you get a copy too when I do the deposits. Bart Carpenter also does a similar thing for the dances. So we have basically two people that handle cash mm-hmm. in terms of receipts that come in. There's mm-hmm. petty cash. Mm-hmm. That's a different,
yeah,
different
that's
story.
Small. Yeah, yeah. But again, board responsibility, making sure those event reconciliations are done. Maybe. Spot checking them from time to time, again, because you don't have an outside audit. If you, again, an audit would probably check at that type of level. A reviewer compilation would not. So maybe you want to perform that auditor's function internally somehow.
Are you saying, for example, after each event, the end of the evening, that there be a check of the receipts?
You might want to spot check it somehow, like for example, Rob, if you went to one of the concerts and you counted heads, 50 people there, and compare that to the reported ticket sales. If the sheet says 40 tickets sold, you go, what's going on here? So that is a very simple way to do it. I'm not suggesting you do it for every event. I'm suggesting maybe random, unannounced spot checks throughout the year.
One of the things that we had instituted last year, it didn't happen every event, but in many, was to have someone from the finance committee attend each event, so mm-hmm. that you have then basically the person responsible for ticket taking, often me or Bart, there, but then a second person there kind of checking things also. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be helpful. Having a second person look at the sheet, also count the money, those types of things is probably pretty smart. And protection for the organization, but also for someone taking tickets.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then the other receipt area, major is your contributions. And again, I don't know your process for handling donations if they all come through through the office, or is that something that may be received at events, or?
Yeah, generally they're a check, not often cash, which is helpful. And mm-hmm. we do use GiftWorks, so we do have a way to record all our contributions. And they come through me, through the office, or the other way they come is, what do we do here? The other way they come is through membership, and that's handled with Bruce and his wife, Joan. So that's really kind of coming into two different sources.
Okay.
But they do go through our GiftWorks donor software. And it is, I would say, 100% cash, or a check, I meant to say. I mean, check is mm-hmm. the most common,
yeah,
thank goodness.
Right. I would expect that. Okay. Good. And then the last area is the invoice payments, making sure expenses are appropriate for the organization, that there aren't personal expenses being written through the business account.
Yeah, I sit down with Jim on a monthly basis, and he goes through all the checks that I've written. He goes through the credit card, and I have to explain everything to him.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes so, two or three times.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a monthly occurrence that he looks at all our numbers, and then he reconciles that against the checkbook.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So he is observing what I'm doing. I'm the one that pays the bills and does the mm-hmm. invoicing, et cetera.
Yeah. Again, good system, what I was expected, but again, it's concentrated with just two individuals. So again, you may want to involve someone else from the board occasionally, just spot checking invoices, you know, again, randomly, unannounced type thing, provide additional oversight.
Practically speaking, how could that work? Someone just shows up at your house and says, I'm here to check the
invoices. Let me in.
How could that work?
Yeah, it I'm not saying unannounced, but you know,
I suffer from disorganization as opposed to, you know, trying to cheat anybody.
Well,
like, oh my gosh,
again, I bring these up as almost as like best practice areas. You know, if the board really does want to exercise financial oversight, fiscal responsibility, these are some ideas that you may want to look to implement.
Yeah.
What about the significance of having multiple signatories on checks and the number of people who can be signatories? What's your advice on that?
It's a good control. I see it at times when it becomes unwieldy if every check needs dual signatures. I would rather see an organization implement a policy where if it exceeds a certain dollar threshold, or a certain type of expenditure requires a second signature. For example, maybe set the threshold at anything over $1,000 requires two signatures. Well, you know, some of your performers probably exceed $1,000, so maybe make an exception for performers. You know, they only require one signature. So you can customize that policy to whatever you think works best for your organization, allows the bills to be paid, but still provides the controls over the key items that are germane to your organization. As far as the actual number, if you have two required signers, I would suggest maybe a third person just to cover when one of those other two may not be available, just again so you don't lock things up too tightly that you can't get a check out because somebody's on vacation for 3 weeks. You want, you know, someone backing that up.
Yeah, so. We've actually done all board members could do the second signature because, and I think we talked about this in your office, we have many events where you don't really know what the check amount is going to be because of musicians getting, if they draw well, they'll get a percentage above their uh-huh. fee. So, you know, if just Jim and I could sign checks, he would have to come to every single mm-hmm. event. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some events that Karen goes to, and then some, you know, some that, you know, depending on where the event is, certain people mm-hmm. will tend to go there.
But
so.
I signed a check, I think, recently, but I haven't signed a signature card. So, by what authority?
No, yeah.
Recognize my signature?
Yeah, and actually, I announced it at the last meeting that they are asking us for new signature cards. So the bank actually only requires one signature.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, I used to be connected with the Humane Organization. I was treasurer and president for a while. I always was concerned about, in terms of like theft. In our organization, the potential to steal was at the shelter level because a lot of cash contributions, mm-hmm. people just pocket the money.
Yeah.
And that was the highest risk, but the amounts involved were fairly low, mm-hmm. small amounts. Mm-hmm. But the potential to steal large amounts of money was with the officers and the directors, right. people who had the authority to sign checks. Mm-hmm. But the likelihood of that happening was, theoretically small. Mm-hmm. But the risk, for each stuff, when a person goes to a trust account, just rob it clean. Mm-hmm. And so it's really tough when you have a small organization and everyone's friendly and you gets along to try to build into these controls the sense of double checking. And I think that's very important. I think and in fact, you just can't pick up the paper or watch television without reading about somebody, the PTO, parent-teacher organization, the guy who runs the Little League. There's a guy who's sitting in federal prison, and I told this story before, I'll just repeat it briefly, who was a classmate of mine in college. He's a CPA so far. I still have his credentials. But he stole from the Little League. He stole from the college alumni fund, and he stole from an estate, a trust that he was administering as a bank vice president. Mm. And everyone was, so he's the greatest guy in the world. Mm-hmm. So these types of things go on. There's always the potential, no matter, how well you think you have in your organization, of theft, of loss. And so I think something like two signatures, even though it can be a hassle, is absolutely a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned in terms of a basic internal control. It means that in order to have some kind of theft, it's going to require the complicity of two people rather than just one person. So that's another, that's more of a complicated fraud if something like that mm-hmm. should occur. And so I'm like, Rob, I would like to know, practically speaking, how can these types of spot checks, audits, double checks can be done within a small organization like ours in a meaningful way that, it still gets the job done but doesn't make people feel as if, they're always looking over their shoulder to see what another board mm-hmm. member is thinking about their activities. But I think just because we are, we go out and raise money, ask people to make contributions, that it's very important that, we do everything within reason to make sure that we're good stewards of that money and that we're just not so accepting of our colleagues that, this is a valid expense, this is, what we're mm-hmm. doing is okay, and not having built-in routine, controls so that we just do it as a matter of course. It's not that we don't trust our colleagues, it's just that this is the proper way of doing something.
Would you prefer mm-hmm. to see a second signature from a certain designated person or persons, or could that second signature be anyone on the board? You think it would be better to have that larger group or better to have a small group?
I just think it's unwieldy to have anyone, right? I just think having anyone be able to co-sign is probably a little bit too large, but I do like the idea of two signatures for everything, because you just mentioned $1,000. Well, you can do a lot of if it takes two signatures to get to $1,000, someone who's of a mind to steal money will say, I just don't have to hit the $1,000. Mm-hmm. I'll just, and most of these types of thefts, that you read about in the paper are long-term, it's done at a very below the radar level, small right. amounts of money, rather than significant amounts that would right. likely draw
That's
attention.
Right. That's right.
So it is the routine. The routine payment is just as susceptible of being, a fraudulent transaction as the big payment is. And so I would really prefer to have, at a minimum, multiple signatories and some sort of routine, just double-checking of invoices, however that can be done in a way that takes into account the worst small organization. Mm-hmm. We don't have, we can't have a big bureaucracy. But I think that that's just
critical. I really do.
Okay. Yeah, I have to agree with that. And if you really want to do it right, and I don't know if an organization this size should do that, but you should have two signatures or at least somebody approving invoices to be paid. You know, just gets it and pays it. Well, that's fine. She should submit to somebody else who look over and say, okay, pay. Then it comes to whoever's writing the check. Two signatures, or at least somebody approve the invoice.
But we do, I mean, we have the expense approved before we do it.
Thank you, Karen.
So, you know what I mean? So we're, I don't want to be doing it over and over.
Right. For example, concerts, advertising. Yeah.
Whatever we're doing, we present it to the board for approval before we do it.
For example, advertising would be one thing.
Like Steve was talking about, a routine phone bill comes in. Well, rather than just pay it, it should be submitted to somebody for approval to pay it.
Okay.
Well, no,
I wasn't talking.
It's going to get complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially since it's already been board approved to have that expenditure.
But it should really start at that level.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, you can impose a lot of controls, but it does become unwieldy for
I'm not against it. I mean, I think that there is maybe a common ground that we can come to. We do already have the two signatures
absolutely.
In place, and I think we should stay that way. And I think it needs to be of the larger group because
absolutely.
We are just not all at the same places. I mean, Jess has already come to the library to get a signature.
That's
so that
right.
She could
I go to Jim's house.
Yes.
You know, actually having the any board member capable of being the second signatory, in addition to facilitating your job, also is a check and balance because it increases the size of any conspiracy to a point where it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And if you can, anyway, that's just something to consider. And then the in terms of paying invoices, if a check is written for that invoice, it requires a second signature on that check. Theoretically, that person who signs the check sees the invoice that's
right.
being paid.
Yep, it's all there.
So that's a check.
So it's with the bill,
yeah.
And then I have to explain it to Jim, so it's like three right. people at that point. So I wouldn't right. want to do any more, please.
Well, the discussion means I think that we're in good stead. I think we're doing what we need to be doing.
I
think that's all.
And particularly because you don't have any external auditors coming in at year end, so some of these functions you do have to take on yourself and
sure.
build those controls in because no one other than the people around this table are looking at this. Mm-hmm. So,
in a practical way, Rob, you were asking earlier how could an organization like this do that kind of spot checking. And one way I could think of is that occasionally we can ask Dale or Karen or somebody to our meetings, and then they could sit there and be asking questions
yeah.
of me and of you.
Yeah.
That could be one way.
Yeah.
I mean, I meet with Dale monthly anyway, and I talk about any larger expenses or any, we have conversations about expenses
right.
anyway, so he's aware of a lot of the stuff that's going on. So that could be part of the president's responsibility on occasion to do a little spot checking.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was thinking is if you wanted to incorporate that into the way we operate, it's the three times a year check or something, and it could be one person's responsibility on the finance committee to, okay, over the next year you're needing to contact, Jess, it could be bring the bank statement mm-hmm. to the concert tomorrow night, call you like that or a few days ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And that'd be their job, and one of their main jobs is just three times a year. I've got to get the bank statement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's not such a hard thing, but that would be their, specifically
mm-hmm.
in their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't be too hard, especially if somebody likes to do that.
I do.
Okay.
I don't know if you found that person, but. So you'd have to write their job description, probably, hey, would you like to be on the finance committee and all this stuff? And then, by the way, you need three times a year you need to ask for.
The thing like the double signatures and the concert sheet that we work on every time, really were things that came out of, we did have a review done by Carol Schneckengard, I think her name is, and these are things that she suggested. Just mm-hmm. like you, she was talking to us about, you know, how do you do internal controls with such a small organization? And for us, practically, when you're sitting at a concert, we don't have a cash register, you know, it's a very informal setup, you know, and we're trying to tighten it up the best we can. But,
well, having multiple people at, one of the problems with concerts, definitely get cash. I mean, mm-hmm. get checks mm-hmm. is a different critter. Right. Cash is where people can pocket cash. Yeah. That's where yeah. there's a potential just to steal small mm-hmm. amounts of money kind of easily, mm-hmm. if you have a mind to do that. So at the concert, one thing is it's very confusing, even though there's just kind of lightly attend, but you know, small numbers, no, you know, generally no more than a couple hundred people, absolute. It's still a lot of activity within a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. So you just have one person there trying to sell yeah. tickets and take the money, make change. You can get confused as to what type mm-hmm. of ticket it is, you know, member, mm-hmm. non-member.
Right.
So just having enough staffing yeah. at the ticket table so that it's smooth and that one person's doing multiple tasks, mm-hmm. that makes it less likely that you're going to make mistakes. And plus, having two people there mm-hmm. more means it's just literally tougher to just pocket money
yeah.
when
mm-hmm.
someone's sitting next to you. So I think that is, just, you know, in its own way, is a very mm-hmm. useful internal control. Just having
yeah.
additional warm bodies that are
sure.
sitting there, mm-hmm. you know, where money is being handled, so that if something doesn't seem to awry, someone might observe it, or at least someone who's, you know, wouldn't have a you know, the likelihood of someone either making a mistake or just pocketing the money is minimized mm-hmm. just by having another person
mm-hmm.
there.
That's right.
It's just a simple thing. It's just a matter of deploying people at a point where there is a potential risk of loss,
mm-hmm.
where the cash comes in at the door. Because that, in my mind, is, you know, again, small risk in terms of the potential loss, but it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even I've done some, you know, kind of money at the door, and we've been off a few times. Sometimes on the, you know, ahead,
yeah.
but sometimes off a few.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mystified as to, you know, how did I screw this up? And so I like the idea of having people there to, you know, with me selling tickets or counting mm-hmm. money. I just think that's make it a routine part of the procedure. It's just, you always have a colleague there working with you on the sales
mm-hmm.
and counting the receipts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least at the larger events, may not be practical to have a second person at your small ones,
we try. Yeah, we do. That's mm-hmm. that's our goal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would say we always do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you take money, for example, and you fill out the sheet, it's safer than me taking it and filling out the sheet, because then I'm the one that's taking it
right,
to the bank.
Right.
So there's really two people.
Right.
You have a number in your head properly,
right.
You know.
Pretty sure that we're going to be over the 50,000 limit at the end of this fiscal year.
Just looking at the, I went from the budget.
I have a question that's a little, it's really off what you've been talking about tonight, but it's a question that came up a month or 2 months ago, and I've been looking into it and I haven't really found anything definitive, and that pertains to whether one takes, taking tickets, selling tickets, one announces this ticket sale as an admission price or a donation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been looking at the IRS rules, and I don't see that there's really any difference between the two for purposes of the IRS. Quid pro quo rule and all, taken into consideration. What, do you have any thoughts on that? Do you know what the difference is? Is there a difference? Is there any significance?
Well, there is. According to the IRS, there is a difference. If it's something beyond what's the ordinary and customary charge for an event, that excess is to be considered a donation. And on your 990 form, you're supposed to account for it as a donation. So if you say we're bringing in the American Bluegrass Band or something, and they're a national group, and normally they charge $50 a ticket, but you charge $75 a ticket, $50 is supposed to be the normal admission price, and that would be accounted for as admissions, and the excess of the $25 would be a donation.
Well, I recognize that, but, so, I'm saying in terms of whether you call it a donation at the door or you call it an admission price, is there any difference in doing that?
Well, I guess if you call it, yeah, I think you might have some difficulty if somebody wanted to then claim it as a charitable contribution. If they said, well, here's the program, and it calls it a donation, I'm taking a tax deduction for this. They should not be taking a tax deduction for that.
Well, they should. I mean, I think, isn't it true that the charitable organization ought to be providing a explanation, a sheet, something or another, to the person who's purchasing or providing the funds, contributing or donating or purchasing, indicating what portion of that entrance amount is for service or for a particular item,
right,
what the value of that service
yes.
is, and then what the excess would be so they can report that excess as a donation, as you were describing.
Right.
So the person buying or contributing whatever needs to know what amount is above and beyond the value, the fair market value of the service. I mean, that ought to be done no matter whether you call it a donation or an admission price. I mean, that
right.
Is that true?
That's right, yes.
So, but I'm just getting to, I mean, it really came down to this very, very maybe unimportant question of when you advertise the cost of a concert, do you say the admission price is $10, or should you say the suggested donation is $10, or does it not make any difference?
Yeah, because you're saying the participant that comes has an option for paying what you're suggesting as a donation, or they can, you can't turn them away if they chose not to pay anything at 10.
That's probably true.
Right.
But then why do that? Why call it a donation?
I'm just saying
there's a chance that somebody will say, I don't want to make a donation, and they come in for free.
You would let them.
Whereas, you know, the IRS says, irrespective of what you call it, if the contribution is above and beyond the fair market value of the service, then a person can take it as a charitable deduction, right? So
is there
any, should we be calling it a donation or should we be calling it admission? Or, that's really the question.
They get goods and services, you know,
in return.
So
yeah.
I would say we can't call a donation unless there is an instance. Sometimes the grants that we get don't allow us to charge a ticket income. And there have been times that we have put up a donation sign and gotten some funding in. So that would be a very practical example.
Yeah.
Now, in that case, they are getting goods and services, but they've already been paid for by the granting organization, supposedly. But there's usually a shortfall, which is why we do it. No one's ever asked me, how can I get a donation? Can I get a receipt? That's a very interesting question, actually.
Well, our name and lights people would be donating above and beyond, like their ticket price would be the $20, but the name and lights is $200 or more.
Right, and we tell them that clearly.
Yeah,
right.
Good. Yeah, specified.
But that would be a very practical time that actually happens.
Yeah.
Do we say donation anywhere? Do we say donation? What's our ticket say?
It's admission. It's not donation.
Okay.
I think that is the better term.
We say donation for the food, for someone buys snacks.
Right.
But on the IRS 990, there is I don't know if Bruce or Jim would answer this, but
there is a
line item for donation and one for ticket revenue or something, isn't there, Bruce? And
yeah.
Right.
You do have to differentiate between
program revenue and donations are separate.
Do we send out a letter, say name and lights people, do we send out a letter to them for IRS purposes saying you made this contribution X amount of dollars over the value of service?
I think that maybe we discussed this a little bit last meeting. I think that the idea of suggested contribution is a usage that is developed with house concerts so that people who run house concerts are not required to pay amusement taxes because they are charging, quote, admission, or there may be some zoning issues about permitting issues. and that's where this, you know, suggested donation sort of comes in. It's not really a suggestion. This is what the charge is, but to avoid, I think, some sort of municipal or local ordinance, that's how that got started. I don't know that it's in terms of, you know, how we, you know, our normal concepts. Now, this is, yeah, your house concept, maybe this is an issue for, you know, how you might handle it, but, you know, show it for an honor, this is the admission fee. You know, it's not a contribution. Right. Right. This is, we're good. Charging $18 or $20 when they come in. And you know, that's accurate unless you really are just asking for suggestion, contributions. Yeah. We're generally not in the business of limit.
But that's a good point. I'm going to look at that aspect of it and look into the, is it a local municipality issue, amusement tax
exactly.
issue. Is that what it is?
It should be amusement tax.
What's their share of amusement tax?
It wouldn't be the taxes because we're a nonprofit. That one doesn't apply to us regardless of. We're a nonprofit, so there's no amusement tax, but there might be municipal something, right. Zoning. I don't know about that. Right.
You still might have a need to have a permit, depending on how the church is run. Bears,
you lawyers, you just heard all this stuff.
Okay.
All
right, well, that gets us to
but there is a difference between Susquehanna folk having a house concert at somebody's house and an individual having a house concert, which is actually a non-entity.
We're probably doing similarly to a lot of small nonprofits, but
actually better than a lot of them, from what I'm learning tonight. So.
Good.
Yeah. So, but I left my name, phone number, contact information. If you have any other questions, please send them to me. I'd be happy to address them before you get back to you.
Great.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So much.